It is said that when Lord Chaitanya would glorify his devotees, he would speak as if he had five mouths. And when he was praising the glories of Vasudeva, he was willing to go to hell for eternity, so that all the beings, he could take their karma and they could all go back to Godhead. That was his prayer. And that was really good for him. Vasudeva Dutt approached Lord Chaitanya with choked voice and said, "My dear Lord, you could fulfill all this because you are independent and supreme. I have only one desire in my life that I wish you to fulfill. My heart breaks when I see the sufferings of all living entities in forgetfulness of you. I pray, grant this one wish, that let all the sins of every living entity in the universe fall on my head. Allow me to suffer unlimitedly in hellish conditions and let them all get liberated. Please fulfill that desire." When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu heard Vasudeva Dutt's appeal, he became choked with emotion. And when the Lord hears, he is hearing from within the heart. Srila Prabhupada explains that the Lord accepts the purpose in which everything is offered. He doesn't accept simply what we say or what we do, but our intention, our motivation. That is what Krishna witnesses from within and reciprocates accordingly. Thus, he knew that Vasudeva Dutt, from the very core of his heart, that was his prayer, to suffer perpetually for the sins of all living entities so that they could enjoy life in the spiritual world. Paradukha Dukhi. A Vaishnava's suffering is to see other suffering. Lord Chaitanya was so affected by Vasudeva Dutt's compassion that he uncontrollably shed tears. His voice was choked up and the Lord's limbs trembled. And when he finally was able to talk, he said, "This is no surprise that you are asking for this, for you are Prahlad Maharaj. The Lord will certainly fulfill the prayer of a devotee like you." At that time, Lord Chaitanya spoke about Vasudeva Dutt's glories as if he had 1,000 mouths. That is how the Lord tasted the nectar of glorifying the devotees. Srila Prabhupada, in that mood of Vasudeva Dutt, performed such incredible sacrifices, left the holy dham of Vrindavan, Seva Kunj, Radha Damodar Temple, suffering through heart attacks and seasickness on Jaladuta, living in the Bowery in New York City, surrounded by drunkards, alcoholics, prostitutes, hippies, having his life threatened. And he did this for people that he never even met. That's incredible. Sometimes a father or mother will perform great sacrifices for their children, or a friend for a friend. But to leave Vrindavan and accept such intense hardships for people he never met before, from strange lands, that was his love. Thus, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, I believe, would like Srila Prabhupada to be honored with thousands of births. And today we're going to have a very special historical satsang program. We have four of the original devotees who personally witnessed and experienced the unlimited compassion and sacrifice of Srila Prabhupada. We have Yamuna Devi, who is famous throughout the 14 worlds, her beautiful singing, her wonderful, wonderful devotional qualities. And Janaki Devi, Yamuna Mai's younger sister, who had a most unique, intimate, loving relationship with Srila Prabhupada. We have Malati Devi, who is fearless enthusiasm personified, Prabhupada's service. And we have Shamsundar Prabhu, who is a creative genius, willing to take all risks and do anything for Srila Prabhupada, who was Prabhupada's own personal secretary for over 2 years. The four of these devotees, Janaki Devi, helped to establish the first temple on 26 Second Avenue in New York. She was the first marriage in ISKCON's history. And it was Janaki and Mukunda Maharaj that brought Krishna consciousness to the West Coast. And there Shamsundar Prabhu and Malati Devi, who had the first child in the history of ISKCON. They started the temple on Frederick Street, which is one of the most incredible histories of Prabhupada's mercy, and how he just instilled the same type of enthusiasm in his devotees that he had himself to give Krishna consciousness. And these same devotees were sent to London. So many of Bhakti Siddhanta Sangha, so these senior preachers went there and found it so difficult to do something substantial. But these six Grihasthas went to London and actually not only established a center with Radha Krishna deities, but literally shook the country. Transformed George Harrison's heart to become a devotee for his life. Made records like Yamuna Mataji singing that were number one songs, popular hit parades. Incredible history in our Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So today, the four of them are together for the first time in 34 years. I wish I had 1,000 mouths so I could speak more about them. I think of it in their surrender and loving service justice. But it is today our very, very great honor and fortune, and I believe Srila Prabhupada's causeless blessing upon us, that we will hear these four illustrious children of Srila Prabhupada share with us and with themselves their love and gratitude for His divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Srila Prabhupada. The great, great days when he was first among us. And what we all felt most deeply was the sense of family that Srila Prabhupada brought us into and made us almost like his children. We must remember we didn't have any idea even what Krishna looked like in those days. There were no photographs, there were no pictures of Krishna, there were no books. Prabhupada talked about Bhagavad Gita, but we didn't have a copy to read. We scarcely knew anything about this country called India, this mystic place in our minds where swamis crawled up ropes and charmed snakes out of baskets, things like that. We know it's kind of a magic place that we heard about, but here was a person from India. None of us had ever met a person from India. Basically, there were no people from India in the United States in those days. What we had when we met Srila Prabhupada was a person. The most beautiful, gorgeous person we've ever seen in our lives. Basically, to start with his physical beauty, Srila Prabhupada was gorgeous in every aspect of his physical body, every one of his mannerisms. Everything he said was so perfect and so charming. This is what we started with. Srila Prabhupada's person, his personality, his beauty, his physical beauty, his charm. We didn't have books. And he seemed to, when he did open his mouth, even get more beautiful. The things he said, everything he said to us, answered every question we had. There was nothing you could ask Srila Prabhupada that he couldn't answer. Nothing. We began to feel, this is what they mean when they say a perfect person. His sense of humor grabbed us all as well, because despite the seriousness of going back to Godhead and finding out the absolute truth, Srila Prabhupada made it always light and humorous, full of fun. Malati and I were, in those days, we're going back to late 66. We were on the West Coast, but we knew Janaki, and we knew her boyfriend, Michael Grant, from Oregon. And they had both gone back to New York. Michael was a jazz musician. He took his girlfriend, Jan, with him to New York. We didn't hear from them for some months. We had heard some rumor they had met some swami or something, but it wasn't. At the same time, we were all, Malati and I were looking for something like a spiritual master, or something to answer all the questions that the drugs and the life we were living failed to answer. So we were wondering what they were doing back there, and maybe Janaki and Jamila can speak a little bit about their first impressions, first time with Prabhupada back in New York, and what some vignettes or some stories about Srila Prabhupada in the very early time, 1966.
Hare Krishna. So, Mukunda, then known as Michael Grant, and I were living on the Bowery in New York City, which is the Lower East Side of New York. It's where the transient people live, and we often had to climb over drunken or dead bodies to get into our loft. And so it was rent control, and so it was like $40 a month, and that's where we lived, and it was very different inside than it was outside. We had probably 27 different musical instruments, because that's what Lucinda made his living doing, was playing music. And so he was in the jazz scene, and I was taking along, and we were doing microbiotics and trying different kinds of ways to heighten our consciousness, and decided it was time to go to India. So we went to get a passport, which we did, and we got our visa, which we did, and we were ready to go to India. But first, something extraordinary was going to happen in our lives, and that was one day Mukunda came home and said, "You know, I met the most interesting fellow that's down the street. He's just down one building, and he's an old man from India. And I think that you should meet him." You know, Bowery old man. So he said he's giving a class 3 times a week, and I'm going to go to the class. He's going to do it Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. And he's going to teach a Sanskrit class as well. So he's going to teach us how to write and read the language. And so that gave him a bit more credibility in my eyes, but still I thought, hey, I'm a little wary. So Mukunda went to go to the class, and he came home, and he was somewhat breathless. And breathless in a very sincere way. Not as though he had met some star, but as though something had awakened in his soul. It was a very profound reaction from Mukunda, and I thought, well, I better check this out. So indeed I did. I walked in, and first of all, you had to walk into Prabhupada's building. You had to climb 3 stories of a darkened hallway because there were no lights. And you get to a door of a loft, and you open up the front door, and the first thing I hear is an almost unintelligible voice talking into a very funky little microphone system, and it's Prabhupada. And I look at the other end of this room, this loft, and I see an old man sitting under a bare naked light bulb, and he is reading out of a book, and I can't understand a word he is saying. It's very foreign to me, and it's rather upsetting. I don't know what to do with it. But then he decides to sing, and so he leads us all in singing, and he's got Hare Krishna written out on a mimeograph piece of paper, and it's handed out to all of the people in the room. So we sing, and Prabhupada plays the drum, and it's an odd experience, believe me, for 1966 in New York City. Well, time passes, and I have to say that this person, we start to go to his classes, and we start to attend lectures, and we're getting more and more attached to him. And as I was walking down the Bowery, often I would see him coming at me, and he's just, you know, he's wearing these saffron robes that are soft and aromatic, and he's, you know, and he's got his umbrella, and it's the hottest summer in New York City in the last 20 years, so it's just like 110 degrees out. And there comes Prabhupada, like blowing in the wind, walking down the street in these saffron robes, and it just sucks your breath away. I mean, mm-hmm. Honestly, it's just, it becomes magical. And so he's living in an environment that is not so good. He's starting to live with somebody that's cracking up, a young man who is not doing very well in treating him rather poorly, and so he comes calling on Mukunda and I more and more, and frequently he'll come over just to spend an afternoon with me, and Mukunda's out, and you know, we really don't eat in those days. It's a very different life, you know. Food wasn't interesting to us, so but it was always to offer what food, and so I would offer him lemonade. I would make some, squeeze some lemons and put some sugar in it for him. And, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Is this okay? Is this what you want to hear?
Yeah.
This
one right there.
This one. And so, Swami, actually starts calling on us more and more, and finally he says, I need to move in with you because I'm not, this isn't working out. And we couldn't, and I think, well, this is going to work out for him to live with us. Like, that's just, we have pot in the house. You know, we can't rob him into our lives. I mean, what, the transition was just diametrically opposed to one another. So Mukunda and I talk about it, and a couple more people get involved in these classes that we're going to, and we decide it's time to get him a storefront. And Prabhupada has urged us to do so, and urged us to incorporate, and urged us to go get some legal papers. And it all happens very quickly. 267 Avenue is born. And it's put together, and Prabhupada is teaching classes and instructing us on how our lives need to change. And one of those things is, are you married?
Mm-hmm.
No. We live together. Oh, you should be married. you get married and then you live together. That's how it's supposed to be, but you forgot. So that's how it happens. And he says, but before you can be married, you need to become devotees, and you need to be initiated. Well, you know, this, and we're in New York City in the middle of the apartment, suddenly is a fire pit, and he's going to put fruits into the fire and put black smudges on our forehead and tell us to follow four basic rules and our lives will be changed. God, what have I got myself into? It's just almost too much. And so that's what happens. We become initiated, and you know, the room is just like so hot. I mean, if you thought it was hot in here tonight dancing, this place is like, there's a fire in the middle of a very small room. What can I say? So we're initiated, and he says all you have to do is no illicit sex, no intoxicants, no meat eating, and no gambling. And that works. We don't eat meat. We have pot, but you know, that's nothing. And don't gamble. Gamble's not important. So we're on this road, and then he says, well, you know, it would be nice to have a place in San Francisco. We need to spread our wings. So
you were going to India anyway.
Yeah, we were going to go to India anyway.
Were you going to San Francisco?
But first of all, he needed to get us married, because now that we're initiated, we need to be legal. And then I'm thinking, well, it's time to call my sister and involve her in this process. since my sister is my only blood family left in this world, I think, well. And my sister, I have no idea what she's doing now. The last I knew, she was kind of going to Reed College, and which is a college in Portland, Oregon, I'm going to say. So, so I call Yamuna out, and Yamuna comes in, and I think I'm going to let her tell you what she finds. But before I do that, I want to say that Mukunda and I threw the I Ching before we left New York City. And I said, you are going to go to the foot of a mountain and and your lives have been changed, and we both threw, as I recall, it was number 64, and we went to,
where we come out? Three Sisters.
No, that wasn't, oh, we did, yes, we did. Well, actually, we went to Tucumane Moon in, what's it, the Southern Point? Anyway, that's exactly what we did. We went to the base of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all. I'm starting to get rattled here. Too much. I haven't really talked in public for a long time, so this is very strange to me. And forgive me if I botched it.
Typically hippies, but they were kind of
whispered, "This is them." She told me about these men at the temple. She was the first woman disciple of Srila Prabhupada's, and there were no other women coming at that time. So she said, I said, "Hare Krishna Swamiji." So the first thing he said to me, he said, "Oh, where have you come from?" And I said, "I've come from Oregon for the wedding." And he said, "Well, how many other family members will be coming for the wedding?" And I said, "I'm the only one." He said, "Oh." Generally, from the family, the woman's side of the family, the many members come. He said, "But that's all right. If you're the only one, that's fine." He said, "Can you help me cook tomorrow?" So I was just stunned. This is before lunch. The guy's kind of like this. So this lunch turns out to be a lunch that Swamiji has cooked himself. And I find out that he's been cooking this lunch for many, many days for all the devotees. Now, all the people that are there are men, and they have very hearty appetites. And the person who can eat the most chapatis is considered a really great soul. And one of the men could eat 12 chapatis at a sitting. So Srila Prabhupada personally not only cooked the meal, but he cooked maybe 75 to 100 chapatis for 12 men. So I had never tasted anything Indian in my life except for mother's curry, which she got out of a jar. And Srila Prabhupada not only cooked, but then began to serve. And he had no shirt on. Again, it was extremely hot. And I had like a little mini skirt, weighed about 700 pounds less than I do now. And a little tank top like all the girls wear. And, you know, I had no idea of dress decorum whatsoever. And so he starts to put the food on the plate, and I'm thinking, "Oh, this looks interesting. A lot of brown and yellow, and some rice." And so I was also macrobiotic at this time, so I was really a little leery about eating a lunch. But because Swamiji is serving, and I'm thinking, "Okay, this is okay." So somehow or another, as he's going around the room, every time he comes to my plate, he wants to put a little more on. And I said, "And I keep, no, thank you very much. I don't want any more." And the devotees are kind of like chuckling. The people that are sitting around the room, every time he does this, they're kind of watching me and laughing about this putting more on my plate thing. So somehow we get through the lunch. He served the whole meal. And then he said, he turns around to me and says, "Now for the specialty." And I looked over at him and I said, "Swamiji, I'm really full. I can't eat another bite." He said, "No, you're going to eat this." And I'm thinking, whatever it is, I don't want to eat this. I don't want this at all. So he goes over to the corner of the room, and in a can with a snap-off lid, he takes his beautiful hand with this two fingers like this, and these three fingers are up in the air, and he reaches in and he picks up a brown ball. And he lifts it up off the top of the snap top lid, and it's dripping sugar syrup. And I'm thinking, I do not want that sweet. Whatever it is, I do not want the sweet. I'm not eating any sugar, and I don't want it. And so he starts to head over towards me, and I go, "Oh, I'm really so full, I can't eat another bite." And so all the devotees are going, "Yes, yes, yes." And Prabhupada's right above me, and he says, "Take, take." And I'm like, "No, no." And meanwhile, the sugar syrup is kind of like dripping. He goes, "No, take, take." So I'm looking for the pot at home to toss this, whatever it is. But he keeps like, "What am I getting?" And there's the brown orb. And then he says, "Eat, eat." And so I put it in my mouth. And as soon as I put it in my mouth, this is a gulab jamun. And as soon as I put it in my mouth, the there's the Gulab Jamun explosion experience. And all the devotees, the minute he goes in my house, start going, Haribo! Haribo! So they know the secret that I don't know about this. So I'm kind of thinking, well, this is a wonderful experience, but I don't know if I'm coming back here tomorrow for another meal. But then he reminds me, he said, so we will cook tomorrow? Can you come? He said, my servant, who generally helps me, he's out of station right now. So that person happened to be a devotee called Kirtan Ananda, who was in a mental hospital. Been in a mental hospital by his parents for becoming a devotee. So somehow or another, he said, be here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. That was the day of the wedding. So I'll only finish this with this one short part of the story and then quit. No, I think I'll tell that later and move on to Malati.
Krishna Prasad, the first Sripadis,
And so they were married, they weren't taking drugs, they weren't eating meat, they changed their names, you know, what else? So after dinner, Mukunda said, I want to show you these books, the really far out books that the Swamiji has brought from India. And he introduced us to Srila Prabhupada's original text of the Bhagavatam. And on the cover, as we're all familiar with the cover, and we now are so familiar with it, we don't think about how unusual it could possibly be to someone who has no introduction to any Eastern religion or philosophy. Because now Eastern religion and philosophy is just very common. I mean, you see the word guru in the newspaper, and quite commonly. In those days, guru was in itself quite an innovative expression. But just people seeing blue people coming out of bubbles with four arms. And then one of these blue people was on a snake with another man coming out with four heads. And when I asked him, Mukundi, well, who is that? He said, this is God. And that was pretty good because, you know, in the hippies, we were all trying to be God, and I was kind of not really buying that part of the hippie philosophy because it seemed like there was a lot of sorry gods around. And this looked like a pretty good alternative. And inside, when he was showing the Sanskrit, the transliteration, the purport, the, you know, everything was... It was hard to take it in, and I was trying to just find something I could understand. And it wasn't that I could understand this, but I kept seeing one phrase repeated, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this beautiful phrase was just saying something in a very special way. And there was only one God, and he was supreme, so all these little sorry gods. They were going to San Francisco to start a temple. And I remember asking him, well, what's a temple? And he very seriously responded, it's a storefront painted white. So he asked us if we'd like to help, and I was thinking, well, that wouldn't be too hard to do. But we were there under a contract. We couldn't leave until it snowed, so, you know, well, when it snows, we'll come down. But by Krishna's arrangement, it actually snowed the next day, so we were able to leave and travel to San Francisco.
I know that in all the years that I was with Prabhupada and saw all the different devotees reacting and interacting with the Swamiji, thousands of devotees, I never saw anyone who had the same relationship with Srila Prabhupada as Janaki.
Arriba.
Janaki had a very, very special relationship with Prabhupada. It was almost like what she could scold him, for example. And Prabhupada would cringe. When she said something to Prabhupada, he listened very seriously. And I've always been curious ever since then, because I never saw anyone else have that relationship, how you reacted to Srila Prabhupada in New York before we even saw you. But what kinds of exchanges did you have? Any stories that you can remember?
Well, I think it started back when I told you that he was coming over to our loft, and Sundar pointed out something interesting today, that while Prabhupada was a guide and a teacher to us, we were teaching him, all of us, we're teaching him about the consciousness of people in their teens and 20s in the late 60s. And there was a lot to learn. You know, I mean, it was such a different kind of consciousness.
consciousness. Now, Prabhupada came to the United States with a mission, and that was to fix people up with going back to Godhead. Easy. So, I mean, he had to learn about what we were doing, and we had to learn about what he was teaching us. And the combination was just very intense. And I was rather a skeptical person, as I kind of pointed out to you in the beginning about being Prabhupada. But when I would ask him a question, his genuineness and his sincerity could not be matched. And so, almost very quickly, I learned to trust this man implicitly and to listen to what he had to say to me. But it wasn't the kind of relationship where I bowed. I mean, I loved to kiss his foot. I mean, that was a great honor to me. But equally as much, I liked to cuddle with him, and for him to pat my head when I was feeling bad, or for me to, you know, hold his hand when he was telling me about what a wonderful person his sister was after she had died. So we had some really nice exchanges. You know, that sounds really odd. We had a relationship that was very unique, I am told, and I believe it to be true, and I believe it to be true to this day. But my exuberance in being with Prabhupada was very sincere, as much as his was with us. And so when I say, in San Francisco, Mukunda and I lived three doors down from him in the same apartment building, and so my cat would go take naps in his bathtub. And so, you know, he would have to come over and go, "Janky, black cat is in my bathtub again." Oh, you know, he was very tolerant with me. You know, when I whipped whipping cream for the first time and went barreling down, I was so excited for him to taste this. That, you know, he had never had whipping cream before with sugar in it. And Prabhupada was teaching us how to be very disciplined people, but, you know, I was so excited that I implored him to dip his finger in this bowl of whipping cream. You know, in the, I don't know where. I mean, you know, it was in the bathroom, but it was, you know, it was an appropriate place. It was maybe in the living room, and it hadn't been offered, and so he would, you know, dip his finger in and go, "Oh, my." I so enjoyed just
like the artichokes.
I don't remember the artichokes. Oh, yeah, I know. I'm hearing a story about artichokes. I don't know. So, you know, that was the kind of relationship we had, and it was very different than I noted one what he had with Yamuna. Yamuna, he was quite a disciplinarian with her. And of course she had such responsibilities. I wasn't like that. I was, you know, when I asked him, "Do you have any children?" I mean, he didn't miss a beat in saying, "You are not my child. You are not all my children." And then, you know, the sincerity. It was just, you know, it was enough to just, oh, it was like going home. It really was to have that kind of response. It was so real, and nobody could ever take that away from him. And nobody was going to walk away from that, or nobody could take that away from me. That kind of unconditional love was just extraordinary. And as we all know today, 30 years later, or with the little kids in this room, you know, and they have many years to go, unconditional love is a gift. And it's just so weird. So anyway, I found today that if we were sitting around the room reminiscing about these stories, that I would start to think, and Malati could
that I've had somebody to do that with. I mean, Yamuna and I do that, but Yamuna and I are sisters, and so, you know, Yamuna and I have cooking to talk about and that kind of thing. Yeah. And so Molly says, I am not your sister. So, yeah.
Ayiva!
Touché. So, anyway, it was a lovely day, and I'm kind of just totally overwhelmed.
Ayiva!
I remember one time when she was up, I was sitting in the airport lounge waiting to go back to New York, and he had his ticket in his hand, and he reached over his shoulder and took his ticket away from him. And he walked off like, you weren't going to give it back to him. And Prabhupada got really alarmed. For sure. Because you were such a naughty girl all the time with him. You were stealing his ticket.
I was.
He was very seriously concerned you weren't going to give it back to him.
Yeah, she said, now you can't go,
Swamiji.
Yeah.
Now you can't go,
Swamiji. Yeah. Listen, I want to say something about my sister and I. We Jamuna. I left Krishna consciousness because I was disillusioned with, believe me, it was not Prabhupada. I was disillusioned with some other issues. And so I left Krishna consciousness, and it was my sister and Dina who brought me home again. And through consistently just being kind and loving and humorous and sending me, you know, books to read and just sending me invitations to come up and play with them and be in their association, Yamuna and I have a much deeper relationship than cooking, so I don't ever want to diminish that or undermine that. And Dina is absolutely my sister as well. And Miss Black Berger and I both well into the arms of Krishna consciousness again. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you.
A story about the early days. I think what's been being brought out here also is that we have to remember from those days how lenient Srila Prabhupada was with us, how he slowly brought us into Krishna consciousness by just through his love and his beauty and his charm. Maybe you can remember some story.
So I'll go back to New York. This is day two. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. And I walk into Shiva Kumar's apartment. I still have on the mini skirt and the tank top, and it's really, really hot. So I've never liked tea, no matter what. Anyway, he overlooks the dress, and he said, please come into my office. So there's two rooms, a bathroom, and a galley kitchen. And when you go into this other room, there's a little grass mat on the floor, and in front of it is a metal trunk. And that's Srila Prabhupada's office. And on top of his metal trunk are a few pieces of his personal possessions, and they're all very impeccably placed. I remember looking very neat, but very Spartan, very much like one would think a sage, not very many possessions. But in the corner it was the right-hand corner end of his trunk, was a stack of cards. And in those days, the hippies didn't really think of using business cards. Wasn't even on the menu. So Srila Prabhupada picked up a card and he handed it to me with great pride and said, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And he said, I'd like to give you one of my cards. And I said, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. He said, would you like some more? Okay. He said, do you have some friends you can give them to? I said, well, yes, I could do that when I return to Oregon. Who in Oregon is going to use this business card for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness? But I graciously take the card. So then he said, So we need a few ingredients before we do the cooking. Can you do the shopping? So I've never been to New York in my life. And I said, yes, I can do the shopping. So he said, yes, just on the corner, there's a grocery store, and you can pick up a few items there. So he had maybe 4 or 5 items, and I don't even look what's on. But I go down to the grocery store, and when I look at the list, I see one says HULD, H-U-L-D. So I look to the to the little Korean man, and I said, do you have some HULD? No. I think you do, because my Swamiji said that you have HULD. No, HULD. So I think, okay, he doesn't have any HULD. So go back up, and the first thing that Swamiji says to me is, did you get everything on the list? And I lie. The first day, yes. So he opens the bag and there's 4 items instead of 5. And he said, where's the hook? And I said, the man doesn't know what hell it is. He said, I am sending my man there. He is buying all the time. I said, is there another name for hold? He said, turmeric. Oh, okay. Do you want me to go back? No. So the first wedding feast in ISKCON was cooked without any haldi or turmeric because I couldn't do it. So Srila Prabhupada, there's this little galley kitchen. Galley kitchen means there's one side is sink and little counter on both sides, little refrigerator. Other side is little counter. So I'm sitting in the front room. And Srila Prabhupada said, so today you will make one dish. Okay, Swamiji. It is called Ankachuri. Okay, Swamiji. So he puts down in front of me a pitcher of water, a bag of flour, and a couple pounds of butter. And says, please make a medium hard dough. So I said, would you like a pate brisé or a chou-en-fou? And Prabhupada said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 25. Swamiji. He said, you're 25 and you can't make a medium hard dough? So immediately I'm feeling a little bad because the first thing he asks me to do, we're having a cross, we're not understanding. I'm not understanding what a medium hard dough is, and he isn't understanding what pate brisé is. So here's the story of how we're learning from each other. So he said, in India, any girl 7 years old, she can make a medium hard dough. So now I'm feeling insulted. My false ego is just rising to the surface like cream on cold milk. So he said, I will show you. And that's the first time that I watched Srila Prabhupada's hands touch ingredients cooking for Krishna. And he made a dough like something I'd never seen before, because we know that pate brisé, we handle very little as a pie crust dough, so you don't need it, you barely put it together. But Srila Prabhupada made a dough where he kneaded it vigorously, as you know, for kachoris or samosas. So then he said, there. And I said, well, thank you very much. So then he brought in some mashed potatoes, and he took some spices and he put them in. And he showed me how to make a kachori. Now, in pastries, kachori is the most difficult pastry, surely there is, in our Indian tradition, because it's fried very slowly for a long time. And if the dough isn't right, if the temperatures aren't regulated very well, if the pan is too crowded, if the pastries are not sealed properly, the dish is a disaster. there's really only one way to make the charades, and that's to make them expertly. And I had no idea what I was doing. And so from 9:30 or 10 o'clock a.m. to 4 o'clock, I made the charades in front of Srila Prabhupada, and I watched him in the kitchen, and I remember seeing him, how very expert he was in the kitchen. He was silent, he was chanting Hare Krishna quietly, his hands were so dynamic, he whipped with his hands, he braided with his hands, he tossed with his hands, he mixed with his hands. He chopped by hand. And in the course of me doing the charis for 6 hours, Srila Prabhupada brought out 14 dishes for 100 people. At least 100 people, although there was maybe only 40 at the wedding. He cooked that much for Charles. And just briefly, it's interesting when we say that Prabhupada was very lenient with us. He was surely very lenient, but that very first day in the kitchen, he began instructing me. When about 12 o'clock in the day, I looked at Srila Prabhupada and I said, Swamiji, may I have a glass of water? And he said, go wash your hands. So I thought, that's odd. But I got up and washed my hands. And he said, so this is a different kind of cooking than any other cooking you have ever done before. This is cooking for Krishna. So when we're cooking for Krishna, we don't eat or drink in the kitchen. Okay. So then maybe an hour later, Swamiji, could I have a cigarette break? He said, go wash your hands. So I went in and washed my hands. And he said, no, you're cooking for Krishna. So there's four little things that you won't do anymore. What is that, Swamiji? So do you want to smoke any more cigarettes? No more cigarettes and no more intoxicants. Okay. No illicit sex life. For cooking, Swamiji? Not for cooking for Krishna. No gambling? Oh, okay, I don't gamble. And no meat eating. Okay, thank you very much, Morgan. So, my very first day cooking for Srila Prabhupada, he encourages me that I'm supposed to do these four things, and that I'm supposed to think of Krishna and not drink any water or taste anything that I'm cooking. So I'm thinking this is most unusual, but this is what I'm doing. So the first batch of kachoris that I send in to Srila Prabhupada, he comes back and says they're all falling apart because you're not sealing them properly. So he shows me how to do it again. And I think for my whole life, I'll always judge that kachoris are my water rule in the kitchen. Because I know what perfection is from the very, very first day of watching Srila Prabhupada's hands making kachoris and shaping them. And a kachori is so amazing because although it's fried for a long time over the fire, when it's cooked properly, it becomes very flaky and it is not the slightest bit greasy. And there's a beautiful contrast between the layers that are caused by the oil being just the right temperature and the dough being just the right consistency of flakiness, like you might think of a puff pastry, a fried puff pastry, and a little more dense. So that's the first thing that Srila Prabhupada taught me, and I'm so indebted for that first day of introduction into assisting to cook for Janki's wedding on the auspicious day of
that subject, Malati, I remember a story you told that Pune last winter about how Prabhupada spotted you from his window across the street in the truck, the dairy truck. Can you tell that story?
cooking for Krishna, we had to become accustomed to using finer ingredients than we normally used, such as we stopped using gross cooking oil and we started using butter, and or we turned it into ghee. But being hippies and being poor, not having a lot of money, butter was a little costly. I think it still is probably costly. And so we had to use butter. So across the street from the 518 Frederick Street Temple was a little corner store. And every day there would be a dairy truck that would pull up, and the driver would go and make his delivery. But he'd park in front of the temple because there was no parking in front of that store. So when he would make his delivery, I'd go to his truck. And take 2 pounds of butter. And one day, Prabhupada asked me, he said, because he could look out, his room was overlooking the street. And I was in his room. He said, every day I see you going to a truck, what are you doing? So I was kind of thinking, he must know what I'm doing. So I was trying to think of how to say the truth to him. So I said, well, Swamiji, I'm getting better. And he very casually said, yes, Krishna was also a butter thief. So when he said that, I kind of was taken back, because although he didn't say it, I understood that Krishna could steal butter, but I probably shouldn't steal butter. So then I had to resort to some other means. That's when the bottle collecting days started. They said, you know, there were so many hippies just crawling all over the place in those days, and now we have bottled water, but in those days everyone was drinking soda, and it came in a bottle, and you had to pay a deposit. So they would just discard the bottles, and I'd send squads of people out with bags to collect the bottles, because you could turn them in, and you get the 2 cents or 3 cents back from the bottle. And so using the money from all these bottles, that's how I had to start buying the butter. But referring back to Srila Prabhupada's tolerance, on our initiation, which was the third initiation in ISKCON, Janaki's was the first initiation, actually. Then there was another initiation before they came to San Francisco. And a few of the New York devotees came. So these devotees that came out to San Francisco, they were the senior devotees of the movement, which means they were 2 or 3 months older than we were. And they knew everything, and they liked to let us know it also. So we were initiated within a very fast time after Prabhupada's arrival. He arrived on 16th or 17th of January, and we were initiated. I thought it was about a week later, but a week to 10 days later. It was quite quick. And I remember being handed a list, and the list was the ingredients that was needed for this initiation. So there was bananas, I could understand that, some sand, some bricks, some wood, and 5 pounds of butter. What are we going to do with this butter? And this person told me we were going to put it on the fire. And I just looked at him, what a waste. Because we didn't really have any concept of sacrifice, what was the meaning of sacrifice or oblations. And 5 pounds of butter was really too expensive, so Shyam Sundar was very creative and innovative. And he went to this dairy, like a big commercial dairy place, processing plant. And he managed to get the butter donated because it was butter that had touched some equipment and therefore they couldn't sell it. And he had to sign a release that we weren't going to consume it, because we weren't getting it, put it in the fire. Mm-hmm. So in this way you remember that? So in this way we were able to get our 5 pounds of butter. And so on this first initiation, there was just a very few people that had any idea what was really going to go on. We knew there was going to be a fire in the room, and that our names and our lives are going to change forever. We spent the preceding day making your beads, and I was at Jamuna's, and probably any of you who have been there, you have seen that she still has her original set of Japa beads, because we all had to screen our beads in those days. Nobody had been to India, there wasn't any stores available to buy ready-made beads. So we had these big, huge wooden red beads that we purchased at a craft shop. I think it was Candy Leather Company, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And even our neck beads, they became Tulsi by Prabhupada's desire, but they were just wooden beads, ordinary wooden beads that we strung. And we were bringing these beads, we would channel them. And he was on one side of the fire, his back against the wall, and there was five of us sitting on the other side, and all of the interested hippies and other senior devotees were there. And it's a very, now you know what's going to happen beforehand, but we just didn't know what was going to happen. And so what did happen was that the room just, you know, was very aromatic, first with the incense, secondly with all the hippies, because the hippies didn't always take a lot of baths, but they would use a lot of patchouli oil in particular, and so the room could be quite fragrant. And then, you know, we got these new names that we couldn't understand, that we couldn't pronounce. These beads came around our neck, which was, you know, for life. And then the fire started, and the room quickly filled up with smoke. And all the time, Swamiji was chanting some mantras, and we were expected to repeat them. And then they handed us each a banana, and that seemed like a familiar object. So we started to peel it. And we were, you know, we had to put the banana on the fire, so we put the banana on the fire. And, you know, you feel kind of bewildered because the room was just filled with smoke and incense, and the chanting was kind of haphazard, and you really couldn't understand what was being said that easily. Prabhupada's English was quite heavily accented. So after giving us the banana, he said, it sounded like bono, bono. We couldn't really understand what he was telling us. And one of the initiates, his name was Harvey Cohen, and he became Haridas. He was a little older than the rest of us, and he became our first temple president in San Francisco. So we kind of looked to him. He was a little older. He should know a little more than we should know. So his take on it was this. He got leaned forward, so we all leaned forward, and then he just started blowing on the fire. So we on the fire. In the hippie lingo, there was a saying, you know, oh, that blew my mind. Well, there wasn't a whole lot that you could do that would blow Prabhupada's mind, because after all, he was constantly associating with Krishna. So, I mean, who could do anything more than Krishna could do? So, at the same time, there were often small things that would happen that Prabhupada would actually express some degree of surprise. And the way you could notice it was his eyes would become very enlarged. So I remember looking through this fire that was going in his face. And for the first time I saw these saucer eyes, these big eyes. So we could understand maybe this wasn't what he wanted us to do after all. And in the meantime, he just picked up his cartels and he started a kirtan. What he was trying to do, of course, was to tell us to bow down, which, you know, the very fact that he would need to tell us his newly initiated disciples to bow down indicates the degree of our advancement was very minimal, and the degree of his tolerance was very extreme. So he did one thing that he knew would save the situation, and he began to cure tongue.
Arriva!
God!
We had a dance, a large dance, the Monica Rock dance at the Avalon Ballroom and the night before. And we had made some money. I think it was $2,000 or $3,000, $2,500, which was a lot of money in those days. So I got word, Mukunda came over to me, or Michael, yeah, Mukunda, he was Mukunda by then, came to me and says, "The Swamiji wants to see you." And I said, "Oh, I haven't met the Swami yet." So I went up to his room with great trepidation. Always, and to this day, those were always the most exciting moments of my life, were standing outside of Srila Prabhupada's room, ready to open the door. I mean, I probably did it 1,000 times subsequently, but I never lost that thrill, that premonition of excitement that whatever happens inside this room when I go in, I won't be able to predict it. It'll be a surprise. You could never know or never tell what Prabhupada was going to do. From moment to moment, you could never predict what Prabhupada was going to say or do. But this was, I was just shivering in anticipation as I opened the open door and walked in. There's the Swamiji sitting in his little mat on the floor with his little table, and three or four devotees were there. And he looked at me with that beautiful grin. He said, "So, you have made some money?" And I said, "Well, it was a group effort. We had, yes, we made some money." He said, "How much?" And I said, "I think about $3,000. And that was it. The bug-eyed look. Whoa. Once Prabhupada gave you the bug-eyed look, you were hooked forever. The rest of our lives were meant to try to instill that bug-eyed look in Srila Prabhupada. I mean, everything I did from then on was to try to get that look back in his face. And when he looked at you with that bug-eyed look, it was like the most, I pleased him somehow. I keep a black and white photo. There is a photo of Prabhupada going like that on my screensaver on my computer, so that every time I turn it on, I get that right away. absurd the world is. But he said, well, if you have made the money, then you must know how to spend it. Someone who makes money must know how to spend it. Do you know bookkeeping? And I said, no. I had taken some course in high school, but I didn't remember much. He said, then I will teach you. You come over here and sit down next to me. So I sat down, and he was on my left. And his robes touched me, his silken robes touched me. And I could feel these vibrations, electrical vibrations going all through, especially in the back of my neck and shoulders. I never felt anything so good. I didn't know what, you know, I felt like I'd better than any drug I'd ever taken. Just like a buzz right there. Years back, I'm looking back at it, I always thought of Prabhupada as someone very big, much taller than I was, and much sitting in that seat when I try to remember sitting there next to him, he always seemed much bigger than I was. And yet he was very short in stature. But he asked Mukunda to get a piece of paper and pen, and he very patiently showed me how to take a straight edge ruler and make a line across the top and one line down the middle of the page and put expenses on income on one side and expenses on the other. And he grilled me on the technique and he said, now every day you will come here and I will teach you more about bookkeeping. So for 3 or 4 mornings I would come in and I had to have all the receipts. If I didn't have one receipt that somebody spent on $2.30 for ghee or something, Prabhupada would be very upset. Well, you cannot, you know, these books have to balance. So in that way, Prabhupada taught us the most practical things from the bottom. Another incident from those days demonstrating Prabhupada's leniency with us, his love for us, his compassion and his tenderness, is that he was learning from us that people in the West are very attached to their pets. This was something new for him. In India, no one wants to keep a dog, right? You see a dog in India, you want to get across the street to get away from it. And we had this dog. Yeah, I had this dog. Even I saw an old clip that Yadavara had from the airport greeting, San Francisco Airport, when Prabhupada first arrived. And there's our dog, Ralph, jumping around in front of Prabhupada. In those days, they even let you take your dog in the airport. And Prabhupada never said anything. He never said anything about our dog's name is Ralph. And sometimes we would even go, Prabhupada liked to go on the freeways. This was something new. We didn't get this in New York, but in San Francisco, we had a freeway system downtown. So whenever we took him somewhere, we went on the freeway. The old car that Jayananda had donated to the temple, I think it was a 1950 Ford. 54 Ford. And the front seat was broken, the passenger seat, so it bent way back. So Prabhupada, and he had written psychedelic lettering all over it, Hare Krishna. All over this thing, like Ken Kesey's bus. And Prabhupada would get in. You sit down, you could barely see the little tip top of his head over the shoulder. He sits so dignified there. And he loved to go 70 miles an hour down the freeway. It's a new experience for him. And usually, my dog was in the back seat. Jamuna found an old photo today. She was showing us of our first Ratha Yatra festival. It was an unbelievable photo when you think about it. It's a flatbed truck, and this is the truck on the side. Each one of the devotees, Janaki, Jamuna, and the others, are all doing different things in the back of the truck. And I'm behind the driver's seat, my aunt, with a big grin on my face, driving, and my dog is sitting beside me. Finally, Prabhupada said we had to get rid of the dog, and we did. Very slowly, he brought us up in the Vaishnava tradition. And but the, I think what he captured, what he captured us with, was his sense of adventure. As we were all like young and adventurous people to begin with, that's why we were there in the Haydash. We were looking for some answers, some wild new adventure to take us someplace different. We loved that in Prabhupada. He had that sense of adventure like nobody. And what he did as an old man to come over and on his own with no money to the United States and do what he was doing, sit down with us, live with us, was the most biggest adventure we could think of. So he was our example, adventure, and the magic. We were growing up in a magic atmosphere to begin with the great culture of Haight-Ashbury. And Srila Prabhupada loved, he seemed like everything he did was magic. He fit right into the whole magic carpet ride that we all loved to be on. He attracted us that way with the conception that if you just believe in Krishna and surrender to Krishna and do everything for Krishna, Krishna will take care of everything. You don't have to worry about anything. Krishna will take care of it. We love that. And it seemed to work. As we began practicing devotional service, giving up the things that he asked us to, everything became even more magic, to the point where we began to expect it. Every day we would wake up and go, oh boy, another day with Srila Prabhupada. Because more magic things would happen. And the third thing that really captured us was his humor. He always did everything with a very light touch. He made us laugh. I was looking the other day on the database, the website where, computer program where all Prabhupada's lectures are spelled out, translated. When they put in parentheses, laugh, everyone laughing, or laugh. In some of those lectures, there's over 100 laugh periods. Prabhupada's lectures were fun. He made us laugh. He made us see how absurd our lives were and how fun Krishna consciousness was. He was always grinning and laughing and telling jokes and pulling jokes in almost like a practical joking manner. So these are some of the things in the early days that really attracted us to Prabhupada. And from these crude beginnings, bookkeeping, cooking, this, that, little things that Prabhupada taught us, very quickly, in 3 or 4 years, we were spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world. So Prabhupada was expert in everything. That's one of the main attractions for us in those days. Do you have any other early story from Prabhupada?
With your permission, I think it's probably time for us to wrap up. Yes. I did want to say that the mood with which we approach this together is giving you a glimpse of behind the scenes information that you might not see in the formal Lilamrita. Things that you might not have heard before, but every aspect of Srila Prabhupada's presence with us should be treasured by us and shared with each other. And I'm just so grateful. I can't say how in my alone hours I think of these three people that are sitting next to me with, you know, the deepest love and affection and respect. Each one of them served Srila Prabhupada when he was on the planet personally with such conviction. If there's the 100%, they were 1,000% attached to Srila Prabhupada in serving him. And this very early phase of ISKCON's history of New York and San Francisco was very family-like. And I think it's an aspect of Prabhupada's legacy that we cannot embrace or glorify enough, that the Vedic literature says our mother and the spiritual masters our father. And you may have a different spiritual master by the grace of Krishna. But no matter what, if we embrace this,
that we are all brothers and sisters, and we have the most exalted parents that living entities can have on this planet. In order to honor that, we should try to imbibe this mood of love and respect for each other. We will all have problems with each other. It's inevitable in the age of quarrel and hypocrisy and illusion. But this mood that Srila Prabhupada set up makes me, to this day, whenever I think of one of these three people, my heart just is completely clear with nothing but love, honor, and respect for them because of how they embrace Krishna consciousness, how they serve Srila Prabhupada, how they learn from Srila Prabhupada. And I pray that so much for us, all of us, that we go into this mood, that we forgive each other for our faults, and we help each other through difficult times. And in this way, we'll be honoring Srila Prabhupada for what he gave us during these years of 1966 and 1967. Such an opulence, and if we don't use it, we'll lose it. And I just thank you all so much, and I think being 7:30, this is later than we've ever had programs since in the history of this. So,
well,
thank you all.
Started.
I know, but yeah. You'll have to ask them what they want to do.
Do you want to take time for questions?
This is I was wondering if Malati could tell one story that she's related in the memories. It's a really wonderful story about Prabhupada for her.
Yeah, it's in Mayapur.
When he was in the room with this guy.
Mayapur, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that possible? Encounter
you'd have to, in those days there was a little slope up to the road to Bhakti Siddhanta Mark. And there was no fence, there was no vendors, there was just the road. So you'd crawl up to the road and walk down to the ghat where you would take the boat across the river to Navadvip. And you would generally have a big argument there because they would try to, as we say in English, rip you off, because being, you know, the white foreigners, the newcomers, they would give you a special surcharge for getting on the boat. But I didn't have any extra money because our treasurer knew exactly how much it was going to cost, so there was no way for me to pay any more. So it would be a really heavy fight just to get across the river, and then on the other side they'd have an argument just to get off the boat, you'd have to pay again. And then you'd have to get on a rickshaw and have a fight with the rickshaw while I got the price. And then you'd go to the sabji market and argue, and to the market and argue. The whole morning was like a battleground. And then you'd go back and the whole thing all over again. And so after, you know, that was the beginning, and then you would have to cook. And the cooking was in the back of the little brick building, and I had a little kerosene stove, the kind that would blow up in your face quite frequently, and a bucket with some holes in it, and the beautiful cooker that you live in has. This is how we cook the Jiva Prabhupada. And halfway through, the person who would give the massage would come and grab the bucket of some heat water for Prabhupada, leaving me with the death-defying kerosene cooker. So it just made it really difficult, you know. If you can imagine making chapatis on a kerosene cooker, I can tell you it was not a nice experience. And you have to have everything ready exactly on time when Prabhupada was done with his massage. So with all that going on, plus trying to take care of my daughter, you know, do the wifely thing, you know, make sure your husband had clean clothes and all that, it seemed like I wasn't doing such a good job. And I was meditating really intensely every day on just doing the best I could to please Srila Prabhupada. And I would be thinking, you know, I would start the day before thinking about the next day, what I would be preparing for him and wanting to please him. And every day he would find some little thing that I haven't quite done as well as I could have, or to his satisfaction. So I started thinking that actually maybe I shouldn't even be doing the service, because it seemed like there was always something wrong. And I was thinking, you know, considering all the trouble that I was going through, it didn't seem like maybe I was properly situated. So one day I started thinking, actually I'll find someone else to do the cooking. And as I got that idea in my mind, I started to feel a little relief from all the anxiety I was feeling from this situation. So I thought that I would tell Prabhupada the next day. And that day I was really peaceful. I thought, you know, my problem was solved. Somebody else was going to cook and I wouldn't have this anxiety anymore. So the next day it happened that Srila Prabhupada had invited his godbrothers. So I assumed that I wouldn't be cooking on that day because his godbrothers were coming. And actually there had even been some criticism from these godbrothers, maybe not the ones that were coming, but we heard there was criticism on different levels about our activities there, and one of them was that he had a woman cooking for him, and so I assumed I would be cooking that day. But the next thing I know, he was calling me in his room, and he just started telling me what he wanted for lunch. So I thought, well, I can't tell him now that I'm not going to cook anymore, so I'll tell him tomorrow. So I cooked that day, and I remember Anand was there, and he called me to make chapatis. And Nanda Srila Prabhupada's godfather, Jumana Vishnu, was a beautiful picture of him today. He was a very selfless soul. And everything was ready, and I was going to go in, and I pulled aside the burlap curtain that separated the back part of the little hut from the front part. And Prabhupada was at the end of the, I mean, it wasn't such a large room, but when Prabhupada was concerned, everything had a different dimension, so the room seemed much grander than it really was, although it was quite small, but he was at the far end, and his thought brothers were on each side, and it was really intimidating, because they were all very elderly Vaishnavas, and Srila Prabhupada was there, and he looked just like a diamond in a beautiful setting. Now, if you have a diamond, and it's just a loose diamond, it's wonderful. But when you put the diamond in the setting, it becomes even more wonderful. And Srila Prabhupada was looking even more wonderful, surrounded by these, on each side, by his god brothers. But I felt so intimidated that I took my sari and I completely covered my head and my face. And as much as my body, I mean, so I got on my hands and knees, and only my hands were out, and I put a plate of my hands on the, like this, and I was walking in with my elbows and my knees, crawling in, and I put the plate down, and I started to slither back out. And he said, yes, she cooks for me, and I criticize her. And the minute he said that, I just felt this passion, because I realized he understood my mind, that I had this foolish mind. He was actually instructing me, and he was very lovingly telling me what I was doing wrong in answer to my desire to serve him properly, but I was, in my foolishness, taking it as criticism. He said, yes, she cooks for me, and I criticize her. He said, but she would slit her throat for me, and I would do the same for her. When he said that, I just felt very corrected. My whole mentality was corrected. And there was no, because it was true, any one of us would have done anything, and we did do anything he asked us to do, whether we could understand it or not understand it. We wanted to do it simply because he asked us. And we had that love and faith in him. And it wasn't blind faith that some people might think. It was absolute unconditional love that he was giving to us, and we were responding to that. And we knew he would only ask us to do what was best for us, whatever it was. So the next day, I returned to my cooking, I returned to my shopping, I returned to everything, but it was totally ecstatic. You know, it's so much... The fight with the rickshaw man was great. I just laughed at the treasure. The whole thing was wonderful. And I was very happy to be there in that situation. And I didn't ever think again that I wouldn't cook for Srila Prabhupada.
Company after all this time, and that's why this again.